Hello and welcome to the second in our series of podcasts for Equine Health Week 2025 in partnership with Argria, covering all the key life stages that our horses will go through. In yesterday's episode, we learned about breeding and the very start of a foal's life. And now we have kind of reached the point where it's time to wean that foal, take it away from its mother and give it the right foundations and experiences to ensure it's in the best possible place for its future ridden career. And to join me to talk about this is Brad Hill. He is the Clinical Associate Professor in Equine Clinical Practice at the University of Nottingham's School of Veterinary Medicine. Bit of a mouthful there, but I have got through it. Having previously worked in first opinion practice, Brad, who breeds his own sports horses, has a keen interest in equine behaviour and horse handling and has previously presented on these topics at the British Horse Foundation's Better Beginning Conference, which you can access online through the British Horse Foundation's website. Welcome, Brad.
Thank you very much. I'm super excited.
So am I. I'm really hoping I can learn some stuff today. So let's crack into it then. So the weaning process, that's kind of where we're starting today. What can we do and how can we manage that process to minimize the stress and give the best outcome for mare and foal? Because I'm imagining that's quite a sort of, it could be quite a traumatic stage in this young horse's life.
Yeah, I mean, exactly that. I guess there's a few different points really to pick up on in that first question. And the first really is, what is weaning all about? So weaning in two parts is about the termination of suckling, so the foal is no longer going to suckle milk from the dam, but also separation physically from the mare. So it's kind of two parts, and if we look at the science and look at what horses do naturally, they do tend to do that at different ages. So foals will generally stop suckling, so drinking the milk, around 9 months. But they will maintain a close bond, or certainly be in the presence of the mare, right up to 1.5, if not 2-3 years. So that's the kind of natural setting. So I suppose that's always the place where we've got to start. You know, what do these horses actually, you know, do in a natural environment? So building on that, I think we've got to then think about doing this in a way that we can try and replicate that, but within the kind of environment that we now keep them. And again, that will be very individual to certain breeders. So you might just have one mare and one foal, which probably isn't ideal because they're herd animals, or there might be a large stud where you're breeding multiple foals. But as I said, foals, if you kind of allow them to do it themselves, will stop suckling at 9 months and then probably start to kind of move away from mum 1.5 to 3 years. So it's a gradual process, and I think that's the big game changer that we've learned over the last few years. It's not a sudden separation, which is traditionally what we've always done.
Yeah, because I suppose traditionally it's always been quite a sort of sudden, right, we're just going to take you away and you're just going to have to get on with it. But that's not the process we're sort of seeing nowadays, is it?
Yes, no, it's not. And I guess that's where my interest started, because I bred I had a mare that I bred 3 or 4 foals from a long time ago now. So around 10 years, probably just slightly less, the last one. And I didn't know what I was doing really about, I mean, I was a vet, an equine vet in practice, but that did that make me an expert about weaning? No. So I just did what everyone did, which was lock up the foal in a safe, confined box at around 5 months. And took the mare away and just, you know, waited for the foal to calm down, which, you know, took probably 2 to 3 weeks. And looking back on that, it was traumatic for the foal and traumatic for me, but I was very confident that that's what you were supposed to be doing. And I think because then I followed these horses, these foals, because they've been mine throughout their training, ridden careers, handling, I have seen the effects of that, and actually, you know, lifelong effects of that poor weaning practice. So that's what spurred my interest in the research, looking at weaning, because I thought, I've done it badly, people need to know how to do it better.
So how should we then be doing it? What's the best way?
So I guess, you know, going back to that point, which it's really up to what you've got. So if I was to do it all over again, I wouldn't have one mare and one foal. I think that's where we need to start, is that you really need to be teaming up in a herd, at least to have two or three mares that are foaling at a similar time. You ideally then want to have a process where you can gradually wean them. I think if you want to do it at the earliest, probably 7 months is the earliest. And that difference between, say, 4 months and 7 months is massive in terms of their development. So 7 months is the earliest, 9 months is ideal. Make it gradual. So take the foal, you know, take the group of foals and pop them in a separate paddock, and then allow them to maybe come back with the mums for a period of time, and then build up that separation period. And what you'll find is that they'll pretty much do it themselves. My only caveat to that is that if you've then got a group of foals around 9-10 months that you've then weaned off and you've separated, and they're in a little like nursery together, then they're not really going to learn social cues from elders. So it's a bit like Lord of the Flies. And I know big studs do this, and I've had lots of conversations with lots of really reputable breeders, and they have these big fields of youngsters at that age. And they all sort of go around like, you know, happy teenagers and, you know, growing into you know, adulthood. But they're not learning social cues from older animals. And the research in other species, for example, elephants, is that really you want a multi-age group for these foals when they're weaned to learn from, because it's a bit like young children, isn't it? You know, they've actually got similar brains at that stage, and like, you know, they're very much in the moment. Toddlers are very much in the moment, and they say it takes a village to raise a family. Well, really, in foals, it should be a more multi-age group herd, and that helps in that. So yes, gradual process, no earlier than 7 months, ideally 9 months. And just literally just separate gradually, rather than a sudden lock them in the box and just, you know, 3 weeks later or 2 weeks later, then probably turn them out with an older horse, which is what I did. It, you know, the long lasting effects of that are massive.
And what are then some of those effects we might see down the line?
Gosh, I mean, the research now is coming out, and I think that's what's most alarming. So we know from other species that if you abruptly wean, particularly looking at calves, then they are essentially not as great at problem solving. So we know that quite early on in calves. There's been some clinical trials set up where you abruptly wean calves, and then you put a group of calves together. So you kind of have the ones that basically go into a little pod on their own, and then you have the ones that are in a group. And the ones in a group, if you ask them to solve a little problem with some food, they can problem solve much better. So their cognitive ability, or able to reason, is definitely affected. So we see that in other species, and we're starting to get some preliminary research around that in foals. Certainly their overall behavior. So we've known for a long time that stereotypic behavior, which is this repetitive behavior, which is an indicator of poor well-being and stress, so crib biting, wind sucking, etc., that is a lot more prevalent. And I know with my own, that's where his stereotypic behavior started. So they're more likely to have stereotypic behavior, they're more likely they're going to struggle to problem solve. And then the other bit really is that they seem to be generally less resilient, so just less able to cope with life. And we see that, I think, more and more now. We see horses in collecting rings with a red ribbon, not only in the tail, but in their forelock. I don't know whether that's because these horses have been abruptly weaned, but certainly horses that are abruptly weaned are less able to cope in social situations, because they don't understand social cues, because they've been isolated. They're likely to be less resilient, so they're less able to cope. They're probably less able to learn and problem solve. So all in all, it can make a massive difference. And certainly with my horse that's now, the one that is now competing, he's 10 or 11, wow, he's been on a journey, because he's struggled in all of those areas. And if you have a horse that struggles with all of those things, it makes training them, riding them, doing anything with them at whatever level challenging. And when I've delivered a talk at the BHF, the audience was left going, I want to know how my horse was weaned. I want to know what those early years looked like, because it sets them up for life.
And that's the thing, is that, you know, with horses, a lot of the time we don't know that, because they come into our lives later on, and those early years are a complete mystery. I mean,
yeah, and I guess we held some focus groups looking at this, from those that worked within the charity sector. We're dealing with mare and foal pairs a lot, and their argument was, you know, when you go and buy a puppy, you immediately want to know the dam, the bitch, the environment, the setup. Now, we don't tend to go out and buy foals. Certainly, you know, the majority of horse owners wouldn't do that. But having some kind of idea of the chapters in that horse's life would be really interesting, because then you might just understand why he doesn't like being out on his own. You can't ride him in a collecting ring, you know, all these sort of things. And if you just looked back on that, it might just give you that information as to sort of what went wrong. So hopefully all of this is kind of evidence to make everyone listening think, gosh, if I'm going to go down the breeding route, the weaning, I need to really get right.
It's like I said earlier, it's that first very big trauma, stressful event in that horse's life. And it's like with kids, if bad things happen with human children,
yes,
you know, it forms them and informs their life for quite a long time. And it is the same with horses.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, it's funny you mentioned talking about kids. So I've done a lot with adoption, and actually we talk a lot about ACE. So, you know, those adverse events that occur in childhood. So, you know, ACE standing for adverse childhood experiences. So, and that can actually shape a child's life forever. So the part of the whole adoption process is to break the cycle and actually provide a better start in life. So we're just catching up with horses. You know, we know this in human literature. We know, I've done a fair amount of small animal practice as a vet, and I used to talk endlessly about socializing in puppies and getting it right and puppy parties and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, people would say, oh, you know, my dog, I know we're digressing, but, you know, dogs that don't like other people, dogs that don't like other dogs. We should be doing this with horses. You know, I don't want to be watching the TV or going to the local, you know, or to horse events and seeing horses with red ribbons in their heads. You know, we shouldn't need that. You know, these horses should be comfortable within the company of others. No horse is born, and this kind of leads us on to the second point about friends, but no horse is born not wanting to be in a herd. They have an innate drive to be within a herd. So when someone says to me, my horse just doesn't like other horses, there's a reason behind that, and it may be linked to how they were weaned.
Well, that leads us very nicely on to what we are going to talk about next, which is, you've got your young horse, you've gone through the weaning process. What should the next couple of years of his life look like? How can we put him in an environment that's going to set him up for success?
Okay, so I guess it's just important to reiterate that horses are incredible, you know. So in terms of what we ask them to do, and we expect them to do in those early years, it's absolutely massive. You know, when you think, gosh, you know, they're going to have to carry a saddle and have someone in their back and all of that. You know, you just think, well, how do we ever get to that point? But they are incredible. And a lot of horses, you know, will go on and have ridden careers, and we know that horses enjoy that. So I'd just like to make the point that I am very pro horse sport. You know, that we know horses get a big dopamine, which is the happy hormone fix from competing. We see happy horses competing all the time. So they need to get into this sort of process of ridden work. The three F's are a simple way of looking at it. So if you can provide friends, forage and freedom for any horse, you're going to make them kind of more relaxed, and a relaxed horse is always going to perform better. They're generally going to be less highly aroused. So again, that's kind of linked to horses that are relaxed. So a horse that's more, you know, calmer is going to be more receptive to those early training methods that you're going to implement. So what would a kind of time budget look like? And that's a kind of very nuanced term for what you're doing for your horse in 24 hours. I think you've got to remember that horses will eat 16, 17, 18 hours a day. So it's not enough to, if you're going to keep them stable, to kind of give them their hay net at 5 o'clock at night, drive off, for they finished at probably six or seven if you're keeping them in a yard remote to you, and then they stand with no forage till 7 a.m. in the morning. They need to be, you know, trickle feeding over a longer period than that. So they need forage. They need freedom. So if they need to go out, and I think another, you know, interesting point that we now look at is that a lot of the turnout that horses have, they should be able to get up to their maximum speed. So if you look at the average size of a lot of paddocks, if a horse literally decided to go flat out, it wouldn't be able to do that. So providing enough freedom is really important. And I think largely, you know, when people buy a property and then get that young horse or have a group of young horses into training. And this, I guess, isn't just a young horse thing. This is a general keeping horses thing, is that you always looked at the stables and the facilities, didn't you? It's like, oh, as long as it's got a nice stable and, you know, an outdoor school, I'm sorted. I think we're changing our mindsets now. We're thinking, is there enough outdoor space / grazing to keep horses? So we shouldn't now be looking at the stables and the outdoor school. We should be looking at, you know, what turnout is there available. So it's absolutely essential that horses get that freedom. Again, another sort of point would be that if you watched your horse roll, and if horses are rolling, that's a really positive sign, in the paddock, and you measured the distance from a hoof mark when it went one way and then it rolls over and goes the other way, and you think, oh, he's gone right over the top. If you measured the distance from one side to the other and then measured the distance in your stable, you would probably realize that it's just not big enough. So, you know, horses need to go out. And another sort of reminder about the importance of that is that, you know, when you turn your horse out, if it gallops off and it goes galloping around and you think, oh, you know, whoopee, he's happy, that's actually the flight response. So you'd really want your horse to just go out and wander about. You know, if he's in flight mode, then he's probably been locked up for too long. So
yeah, that sort of boom energy.
Yeah, they shouldn't have that boom reaction. They should just literally go and trickle, you know, wander around and have a rolling graze. So freedom's really important. Forage I've talked about, and friends. Please, it's not enough for horses to just see each other. Oh, he could see his friends. They have to be able to touch. You know, and mutual grooming is absolutely essential. So horses need to be able to get their heads over and scratch each other's necks. And if they can't do that, then just touching each other through the bars, is ideal. It is probably better, not the kind of ideal, but just to say, oh, you know, he can see another horse isn't meeting his basic innate needs. So friends, forage, freedom, is kind of my advice. I'm not saying that every horse gets on with every other horse, so you have to kind of play around with those pairings, but you should play around with those pairings, because ultimately, when we're looking at starting those young horses off, if you can get those horses into a setting where they are able to mutually groom, they are going out and they have got access to forage, when you're doing that initial training, the difference will be massive. You know, they will respond so much better. They will progress so much better. I mean, when I think about the best yard that I sent my young horses to start that ridden career, they basically had like a crew yard with pens, and the young horses could literally just put their heads over the gates. So they were able to mutually groom. They weren't the standard size stables. They were sort of big, loose straw pens with almost just, you know, large metal gates with boards on. So they were in a much freer environment. They were constantly in contact with each other and they would go out every day. And the person doing that initial training would have told you that he found it a lot easier to get these horses going in terms of that ridden career by providing those three Fs.
Yeah, and I think it's that thing we've got to remember with horses, is that 23 hours of the day, which gets brought up quite a lot, is,
yes,
you know, the thing with the training or whatever it is we're doing them is a teeny tiny proportion of their day, and the rest of the time they have to amuse themselves. And the more we can remember how they operated when they were wild creatures, the better then we can we can encourage those natural behaviours, because that's what we want at the end of the day.
Yeah. And then what's amazing, and this is where horses are incredible, and we get such a kick out of this, is that then when you ask them for that half an hour of you time where you're like, oh, now I just want you to do a little bit of ridden work or whatever, they are amazing, are they not? You know, they just soak it up, you know, they learn, they pick things up. And within weeks, you can literally get a horse from going, having never been ridden before, to doing, you know, walk, trot, whatever, round the school. So the progress is massive if you can get that the rest of, like you said, 23 hours right. Horses will be very adaptable and flexible.
Yeah, and setting them up for success in the best way we can.
Absolutely.
So let's move on to that training point then. We've set up this wonderful environment for our horses, and they are now starting to come in and start to do a bit more sort of structured work that's building them up to the day that saddle's going to go on them for the first time. How can we do that in a really positive way that is going to, well, I've said it already, set them up to get through that process in the best way possible?
So this is where this sort of revolutionary light bulb for me went off, you know, a few years ago when I learnt that horses, I kind of, you know, understood or got the knowledge about how horses learn, you know. And when I was introduced to equine learning theory, it just blew my mind, because I was like, this is the key, you know, this is how horses are actually learning, and this is how we train them. So to split that down, it falls under operant conditioning. I won't get too technical, but the bits that the two aspects of that we really need to focus on our positive reinforcement, so rewarding the behavior you want with a kind of neck scratch, or if you want to do some clicker training, you click and then give them a treat, and it's all about timing. So as soon as they offer the behavior you want, you reward them. And the other arm to that is negative reinforcement, so that's pressure and release, so removing the pressure in response to that behavior. And that is where ridden work, you know, we're doing it all the time. And it doesn't matter what level you're at, you're using negative reinforcement. So keeping it simple, when you put your leg on a horse, so when you kick a horse, pressure of the leg on, the horse moves forward, you take your legs off. Okay, that's negative reinforcement. So you're telling your horse to go forward through pressure of your legs on the horse's side. As soon as the horse steps forward, you release your pressure. Now, the horses that are really well trained should be really responsive to those cues. So leg on, move forward, pressure off. Exactly the same down the rein. So pressure of the hand down the rein, the horse slows down, release the pressure. And the quicker that you can release on in terms of your timing, the quicker the horse is going to learn. So horses take three to five trial and errors. So it normally, and again, riders would agree with me on this because they're doing it all the time. So to teach a horse how to do something, you need to do it between 3 to 5 times. And then the horse goes, oh, I know what your leg means now. So you put your leg on, the horse is gone. It's moved off your leg. So it's learned that. Put pressure down the rein, the horse slows down and release the pressure. Now, that is the fundamental for it all. And that's where we build everything, because then horses realise that that little bit of pressure of the left leg behind the girth and the horse moves to the right, and then the pressure of the left leg comes off. So then you start to teach the horse to go sideways. You know, so that's why, like, you know, some of our top dressage riders have loads of buttons and cues using negative reinforcement, and they're doing it subtly all the time. These horses have literally learnt a repertoire of cues through negative reinforcement over years of training. So it's like having all these buttons that these top riders are just pressing through pressure and release, and then releasing at the right time, and the horse gets it. And you build these up over several years. So anyone that's got a young horse, they're not born doing half pass or shoulder in. You start off with pressure of the leg on, horse steps forward, take the pressure off to get the horse responsive off the leg. And then over years, you build it up. Now, horses don't have great short-term memory, so you need to repeat stuff. So that's why it takes ages to get a horse from being sat on for the first time to Grand Prix, it takes years because horses need constant repetition, daily training, repeating this pressure and release, negative reinforcement over and over again. And then some of the very, very good horses have all these different buttons. And a story that I love to tell is that I lived with a vet student who had a Grand Prix dressage horse. And she said, oh, why don't you ride, have a ride on Wally? And I said, okay, great. Now, I'm not a great rider. And I basically got on this horse, was like getting in a Ferrari, pressed all these buttons because my leg was moving everywhere. And I literally couldn't get him to canter one circuit around the school because he was just doing like two time changes everywhere. Why? Because my legs were pressing all these different buttons and releasing. And he was like, I don't understand what you're asking, but I was just allowing him to do it. So leading on from that, where does that go wrong? If a horse doesn't offer the behaviour that you expect it to offer through pressure and release, so say the horse doesn't go forward off your leg, people will kick harder and then the horse will go forward. Okay, fine. But if they don't release with the hand, then the horse is a bit confused and maybe they've kind of got their timing slightly wrong. So they've kept their contact down the rein, a lot of pressure with the leg. The horse is kind of not quite sure, half stepped forward, and there's been some sort of breakdown in that communication. That's where riders then will introduce spurs, maybe a stronger bit if the horse hasn't slowed down, and suddenly we get all these extra things built in. What I used to see in clinical practice was if you had horses that had been ridden to a high level that were very well trained with very light aids, and then you had a lesser rider like me come along, and maybe not release the pressure of the hand or not release the pressure of the leg at the right moment, the horse got very confused. Sadly, most riders in that situation, if you're not getting the response to the behavior you want, so the horse isn't going sideways or isn't going forward, they up the pressure. If the horse is confused and you up the pressure, the horse is going to get more confused. And then you up the pressure and the horse gets more confused. And you know, as a vet, I would go out and see these horses that have been sold to riders that were like me, you know, less experienced, didn't know why the horse wasn't doing what they wanted. They up the pressure, up the pressure, up the pressure. And in the end, the horse will offer an explosive reaction. So the horse will stand up and rear or buck, etc. And then within months, these horses would be deemed, you know, unrideable, not safe, etc., etc. And that's simply because they don't understand. So if you get a horse that's doing something that you don't that you wouldn't expect, or it's not responding in the way you want it to do, go back a few steps. So we shape the behavior. So if it's not going backwards, if you've asked it to rein back and you're supposed to rein back, then you're asking it in a way that it doesn't understand. Go back a few steps so that it does understand, because that horse will be trained by that rider that's trained it for years and years and years. So when you come along and sit on it, it doesn't understand your cues and pressure release. So you need to go back and start at the beginning. And what I see a lot of riders doing is putting horses back in long reins. I'm a massive fan of long reins. I think that could be amazing. Get the horse back in long reins, you know, get that horse, you know, better on the contact with you, and get that those cues built back in so that the horse understands what you're asking. Because just because it's programmed to be ridden by someone for years and years and years, it doesn't mean that it'll understand your cues. And it all comes from pressure and release, negative reinforcement, get the timing right. And if I had to say anyone who gets this absolute spot on, it's Pip and William Funnell, massive fans. Watch them do their demo at Burley, all about timing, repeat, 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 pressure and release.
No,
I've probably gone on there way too much, but
no, it's really interesting. And I have to, like, as a complete sort of going off on a tangent, I completely agree with you about the long reining, because I brought my horse as a yearling and have done, I'm the only person who's ever sat on it. I've done everything with her, and she did so much long reining because that was the best way to get her brain and teach her those things. And when it came to then putting a saddle on her for the first time, she understood all of that pressure and release thing already. And literally, I took her for a hack the next day. She got it.
Half the work. You basically got brakes because they understand what you're doing, and they understand the pressure of you behind, and they go forward, and then you put pressure down the rein and they stop. So you've immediately got stop and go.
Exactly.
And I think that, you know, I'm a massive fan of that. It's kind of low stress, long reining, and you could take them everywhere. You know, I used to long rein them everywhere, you know, expose them to all sorts of different things. So yes, it takes time, but wow, it does it set them up in the end.
Absolutely. And that was the thing. But again, by the time I got on her, she'd seen everything she was ever going to see out on Hack. She'd seen tractors, she'd seen buses, she'd seen dogs and people and kids and weird inflatable things in people's gardens. And it, yeah, it completely set her up to be a really good, confident hacking horse. And it also meant that she was quite happy to go off on her own and go off in front and lead the others because, you know, because she'd had to think for herself. This is a complete tangent. I'm very sorry.
Sounds like you've done a great job. I think everyone should be sending their horses to you to be started.
Why, thank you. I just enjoy it. I find this so interesting, all this learning theory and young horses and all of that. The clicker training as well. I think the things my horse will do with clicker training is quite amazing.
Yeah. Well, that's it. I mean, I just think horses are fascinating how much they learn. You know, but I think we need to, you know, without digressing too much, we need to remember that really their brains aren't very big, you know. So people get very caught up in anthropomorphizing, so humanizing their horses. Their brains are tiny, they live in the moment, and they learn through trial and error operant conditioning. So when you say, oh, my horse has really got one on him today, or he's being a right idiot, they don't have that cognitive ability. They don't have that cerebrum, which is the middle part of the brain that we have. So that kind of language isn't helpful because you're putting unrealistic expectations on them simply because their brains aren't big enough. So, you know, that's not how they learn. Learning theory is how they learn.
And keeping it really tiny little bite-sized chunks as well. Yes. So like you said, it's that very simple, little bit of pressure and we take it off, or we reward it, or whatever it is that we're doing, whichever positive or negative, keeping it really, really tiny, and then building those
shaping the behavior. And you can, and it's amazing if you get your timing right and you got your clicker, you can click for anything. You know, you can get a horse to do. I mean, a really simple one is that if you're standing outside the horse's stable and it looks away, click, give it a treat, and then it looks away, click, give it a treat, and before you know it, the horse would be like looking away from you going, I know if I look away you'll click and give me a treat. So you could teach these horses anything if you get your timing right. You know, so click as soon as you know, we say normally click within 3 seconds, otherwise you've missed that opportunity. So as soon as you witness the behavior you want, click, treat. Or give the horse a neck scratch. So clicker training horses, you can do lots of groundwork with that. But the negative reinforcement really underpins a lot of ridden work, if not, well, all of it, really.
Yeah, it is the basics. And if we're talking about young horses, do we find that different horses are kind of ready for that next step earlier than others? Or do some take a bit longer? Sort of, obviously, there are physical changes, but mentally as well.
Yeah, and I guess that sort of comes back to the weaning bit, doesn't it? I often think that, I mean, you know, when I look at my horse, oh my gosh, you know, he would be the kind of horse that would never have done a young horse class, because unlike your horse that was going around all the country roads, happy going past balloons and dogs and all sorts, no. And I think then, you know, everything has to come later with that. And I would attribute largely that down to his weaning, but also down to his genetics. So I think you've got to remember that the ones that I bred, I didn't breed for me to ride because, hey, I've just said I can't ride a Ferrari. I bred as performance horses because I wanted to breed the best that I could in the discipline that I wanted them to go into. So it really depends, I suppose, you know, on the individual, what they're bred for. So if you bred a top level dressage horse, they have to be super sharp in their heads and brains because you need them to be very quick learners. But if they're able to learn quick, they can learn the wrong things quick. You know, so you can have that. So it's an individual thing. I think it's linked to genetics, how they're weaned, the environment that you keep them in. But I do think a lot of these horses get kind of pushed aside as sort of no good because they don't match these or meet these unrealistic targets of young horse classes. And we could debate that all day long. But I think they are often a major problem in streamlining and pushing these horses to get going too early when they're just simply not ready. You know, you've got to work with the individual in front of you.
And again, I guess if we bring it back to children, it's like children in primary school and stuff. You'll see some kids that are, you know, reading much more ahead of other ones, or you know, excelling in certain areas, and other kids who take a couple of years and, you know, and eventually then as they get a bit older, they pick it up and off they go. So I guess it's, again, it's the same with horses.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, some horses will do things much quicker than others, and then, you know, other things other horses will do in reverse. So the main thing, which I guess we haven't touched on, is that just always be aware that horses have great long-term memory. So if you do something which induces the fear response, such as have a poor loading experience, or you know, use the clippers and the horse completely loses the plot, and we've all seen horses, you know, jump out of a situation, or, you know, even more disastrous, then they won't forget that. And then we've all seen the older horses where, you know, they're like, oh, you know, you can't shoe him, or you can't load him, or you can't load her. And so whatever you do with your young horse, you know, just make sure you keep it really positive and set them up for success. So we've touched on this again, but, you know, there's some great videos. I saw a lovely video with Sharon Hunt, the event rider, on social media. So she was getting on a horse in the indoor school. I assume it was a young horse. And rather than sort of making the horse stand square in the middle of the indoor school with a mounting block, she takes the horse over to the side. She puts some carrots, and the horse walks over to the same spot every single time. It eats a carrot. She puts the mounting block next to it, and she gets on. And the horse is eating the carrot, and she's on. Now, you're setting the horse up for success. So rather than being like, you must stand still in the middle of the school and wait for me to get on, just take the horse over to the corner every single time, have a carrot there, and move on. You know, there's this idea that we've got to dominate horses, and they must be submissive, and they must, you know, they must learn to, you know, it's all this horrible rhetoric, which we've got to move away from, because we're not working with them here. We've got to work with how they're learning. And I just thought, you know, she's using positive reinforcement. She's reinforcing the behavior she wants. And you know, quite quickly, the horse will go into the school and be like, oh, I'm going over to the corner now.
Yeah, I'm getting my carrot.
Yeah, I'm getting my carrot, so it'll stand still. And you won't need to use a carrot forever. It's just getting that horse over that period of being standing still for you to get on. And, you know, it's like, it's just building up layer upon layer, like you would with everything else that you train your horse to do.
Definitely. And I think as well, it's probably worth saying at this point, if people are, you know, have got younger horses and are going through this process, it's probably worth as well, if you're having problems, is help bringing in help if you need it, and finding a professional who can get you through that, or even a knowledgeable friend, but making sure that that person is working in a way that you agree with and is going through these principles and working with the horse in the right way, so that, you know, we can hopefully avoid the big mistakes that might cause the problems down the line, like the horse that won't load, or the horse that won't shoe, or the horse that won't stand still for someone to get on it.
Yeah, absolutely. Because if you get those bits wrong, and you know, we talk about a lot now, I mean, we're not going to go on to talk about socializers, because I know that was covered last year, but, you know, we talk a lot about accountability. Listen, I look back on my journey with horses, and I have done lots of things that I feel ashamed about, that I wouldn't share on this podcast because I'd be too embarrassed. So we are all on a bit of a journey with this. You know, when I was riding young horses 20 years ago, I made some disastrous mistakes and had horses in a position where they didn't understand what I was asking. And, you know, horses will freeze. You know, I don't know if anyone's ridden a horse which literally just stands still and refuses to move, because they're thinking, I don't understand what the leg is anymore. I don't understand what your hands down the rein are asking, and I don't know what to do anymore, you know. So let's not ever put our horse into a position where they're having to fight, flight, or freeze. You know, it's just not acceptable. You know, if these horses have pushed to a point where they I've seen a horse in a very poor loading situation lie down at the bottom of the ramp because it just did not know what to do. You know, you need to go back and you need to explain, or you need to get that horse to start off with better at pressure and release off the head collar. So just get the horse, you know, horses should lead not by following you, but by pressure on forward, and they step forward and the pressure of the head collar is released. Pressure on backwards, they step backwards and the pressure is released. Negative reinforcement. You know, start there And then move on from that. So yes, we're all on a bit of a journey. Make sure you align with someone that is aware of learning theory. There's loads of great resources. So the BHS, World Horse Welfare, lots of these sites now have got great pages all about learning theory and weaning, etc. So you know, the resources are endless. And I think the biggest improvement I've seen is in the Pony Club manual. You know, the Pony Club have a whole section on learning theory, which is massive. So yeah, people are aware of it.
Yeah, definitely. It's a journey, but the resources are out there if people want them. And, you know, we're only going to improve. The more we do this, the more we'll find out and we'll streamline the process even more.
Yeah, and then when we think about, you know, public perception, which everyone is under scrutiny of, if we can demonstrate that we are using methods which align to how horses learn, then doesn't that just sound so much better? You know, the narrative, if we can demonstrate that we're using language that the horse understands because we're using learning theory, then that's brilliant, isn't it? Because we're talking their talk in our training methods. You know, that I see so many different training methods now on, and there seems to be a big boom in lots of people going around and saying that they'll sort each other's horses out and all the rest of it. And a lot of it uses learning theory, but we need to be able to demonstrate that we are using learning theory, because then I think public perception of horses being ridden is going to improve massively, because we can evidence that we're using language that they understand. And I do think we need to justify a little bit what we're doing now, because for people that don't own horses, the idea of getting on a horse's back is alien. But as I said right at the beginning, we know that the majority of horses are very happy when they're competing. Mm. You know, certainly I've talked endlessly about my own horse that has done everything wrong as a young horse, but actually, does he love jumping? Absolutely. Does he get a dopamine fix from it? Absolutely. But to get him to that point has been massive. And that is the reason why I kind of come on these podcasts and talk about all this stuff, because you need to get it right. If you want a happy horse and a horse that's going to perform in whatever you want at whatever level, you need to get this stuff right.
Definitely. This is the basics, and hopefully we've covered it, and we've gone through quite a lot of stuff here, but it has been really interesting, and hopefully it's got the people listening kind of thinking about how they're working with their own horses and how they can apply that, because obviously all of this stuff we've talked about it in a young horse lens a lot of today, but it does apply to horses at all ages, particularly this learning theory stuff. That, you know, there's no such thing as not teaching an old dog or old horse new tricks.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you've got a horse and you're thinking, gosh, I'll never sort this out, you know, strip it right back and think, well, you know, how can I set him up for success? How am I keeping him? Am I providing with the 3 F's? Start there. You know, if there's an obvious behavioural problem and you've tried all of that, then always think about pain, you know, thinking about something kind of bigger going on. But in terms of a kind of basic training ridden problem, you know, think about learning theory, go back a few steps. And of course, you know, you could kind of reshape that, and you can actually teach them, like you said, you know, lots of different things and improve them just by going back a few steps and getting them to understand exactly what it is you're asking.
Fab. Well, thank you very much, Brad. This has been really, like, genuinely really interesting. I really enjoyed talking to you today. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening as well. If you, obviously, we mentioned at the start about the breeding podcast, you can find that exactly where you found this one. And we have got loads of other really great content with loads of really interesting experts coming up later this week. There'll be podcasts daily on your chosen podcast platform. You can also find everything on the British Equestrian website, www.britishequestrian.org.uk. Thank you very much, Brad.
Thank you. It's been brilliant. Thanks for having me.